So tonight, we're going to look a little bit deeper into this idea of clinging. Since we kind of had that ceremonial thing to kind of interrupt the flow here, I want to go back and just connect a little bit with how I relate to this relationship between grasping and clinging. So I only really see in the cycle of dependent origination, kind of three places that we can intervene and disrupt the natural flow of this co-arising cyclical thing into suffering. The first kind of place is with feeling tones and beginning to sense into when feeling tones are pleasant, unpleasant, and neither pleasant nor unpleasant. If we focus in and begin to sense into our feeling tones, rather than following the impulse, we got this opportunity. Second place I think we can interrupt the flow of difficulty or flow of just going into suffering is at craving. And then the third time is at the end when we feel this ultimate suffering before we go back into habit patterns, we can kind of fill into that suffering then. I think those are the only three places. I think everywhere else, we don't even know what's going on. We're kind of asleep in the process. And clinging is one of those places. This movement, though, from craving to clinging is so natural that it's almost impossible to actually see that happening. So as soon as the body, as soon as we, body or mind, as soon as there's a felt sense of discomfort in any way, this grasping mind, the mind that basically clings, hijacks our capacity. It takes it, swoops it up, and begins to basically assert some kind of control over who we are, what we are, how we are. I think that scooping up and that control comes because of this closed circuit kind of thinking that I talked about in the months of craving. I think when we were talking about craving, I was talking about that we have this closed circuit way of thinking. We only think in relation to what we already know. And we have this system in our minds that creates an understanding around what we know. So everything that fits in our understanding, we agree with. But things that don't fit in our understanding, we either ignore it, we don't see it, we don't agree with it. So there's a way in which the grasping mind controls that, controls what information comes in. And Dhamma is the opposite. Dhamma is a open-ended, everything comes in, let's just see what's going on. So in a way, as soon as some degree of discomfort comes to us, this grasping mind grabs a hold of it and tries to fix it, hijacks the whole thing, tries to fix it. In this kind of this discomfort that I'm talking about is when we have a sense, if we could begin to see how habitual everything in our life is, we could begin to see that everything that we think of as discomfort is really nothing more than not fitting in our habit. So we have an expectation that something's going to work a certain way and it doesn't. Or we have an expectation that I should feel a certain way and I don't. All these expectations come from the first 5, 6 links that create this habit way of being. And in this habit way of being, we never expect it to have any discomfort. And yet it always does, because things just don't flow right. They don't flow the way we want them to. So craving is this link that connects the discomfort, that when we get connected to this discomfort in any way, there is a possibility to turn towards that discomfort and consider, how has this come to be? But often, instead of turning towards the discomfort, we turn away from it. This is the hijacking. We turn away from the discomfort, and in that turning away, the rest of the process on this dependent origination, everything else starts happening. So here at craving, there is the habit that comes before us, and there is the sleep that comes after it. And that craving is like the line that we have. It's where the ouch is. It's where the felt sense of wanting, not liking, liking, all of that is right there. So turning towards the difficulty means that we're not following that link. But most don't feel bad. I mean, it's pretty much all of us. Our impulsive way of being is to turn against it, to turn away from that suffering. And that's when we're kind of trapped in this sleep pattern that picks us up from here on out. What I talked about it last time was, I think of it as the natural capacity of our minds to get absorbed. We mostly think of absorption in the sense of concentration into jhana states and deep practice. But absorption happens in the selfing to me also. So that turning away, we get sucked up into this absorption. And before you know it, we are caught in this clinging. And it's the clinging that I think is difficult to see. I don't even think clinging, I think the clinging, we don't have any direct access to it like that. I think if you want access, we got to step back into the craving to feel the wanting or to feel that ouch. But even though clinging is so obscure that we can't really feel into this absorbed state that we're in, we're lost in, there are 4 ways that 4 kind of types of clinging, and you can associate the type of clinging and pretty much bank on the fact that you're kind of stuck in an absorption. You're kind of stuck in it. So that's what I want to talk about tonight. I want to talk about those 4 ways that clinging kind of, the 4 types of clinging that there are, and maybe look a little bit about how it shows up a little bit, but we're not really going to talk about practicing with it until next week. And next week we'll talk about the implications of what these 4 do and how to practice with it and how to get how to use our wisdom mind to help us. I personally don't think that it helps us unhook ourselves from clinging as much as it helps us take a step back into craving and feeling that ouch and that want again. It's what we're really, I think what we're really doing. But anyway, here's these 4, I guess you can call them ways to gauge whether or not you're caught in some absorption or not. The easiest one, the first one, has to do with clinging to a sense object. So what it really is talking about is clinging to some degree of pleasure or some expectation that things should be pleasing. It's not that we need to get too caught up in the fact that we want pleasure, because every cell in our body, every amoeba, everything, every bacteria, every germ, all the little beings, and we have billions of them in our bodies, they're all aiming for their own pleasure. And they're competing with each other's pleasure. That's why I got to have sugar, because that pleasure, the little bacteria in my gut is like sugar, sugar, sugar. Tori, don't do that diet. It's not enough sugar. Come on. So our wanting pleasure is very much a part of human existence. To put this in perspective here, in Dhamma, what I think we're trying to see is this unhealthy, inappropriate relationship with pleasure, that we become so fixated on it that we can't tolerate anything that's unpleasant, anything that where pleasure is not there. So we put so much of this idea of pleasure in an object that the absorption is that the object is going to give us pleasure. And we forget that it's just our inclination, our underlying tendency to want and seek out pleasure. We think the object is going to give us pleasure. And so we have to have that object. If we don't get that object, we get irritated, we get mad, and we begin to spin as if the thing that prevented us from having the object, that's the problem. And rarely do we turn and look at my initial wanting of the pleasure. Instead, we get irritated, mad, blame, all the things that got in the way and prevented us from having this pleasure from this object. What I think the craving, the stepping back into craving, is when we're able to begin to see that it's the wanting and the ouch of not getting that is our basic kind of doorway to see that we can't always get what we want. I mean, we know that on an intellectual level. This is not something we don't know. We've been practicing this for a long, long time. We know it. So how come it's such a problem when we don't get what we want? This is what Dhamma is about. I think it's all about asking questions like that. How come I get so irritated? How come I'm so irritated right now? And no, it's not because you didn't get what you want. It's because there's an expectation, an absorption that things should be pleasurable and things should be pleasing. And when it's not, it means something's wrong. So we're trying to learn to notice this type of clinging on purpose. We want to notice it. And the only way to notice it is not when you get what you want. As you can see, if you get what you want, you're good. You're just moving along. Life is good. We're all good. Let's just keep going. The only gift is when you don't get what you want and now you're irritated. And in that moment, you could begin to see the link between wanting something that's not present and this not getting it. And then what the mind does when it goes through that process. But this means getting more comfortable with the discomfort of not getting what you want. We're going to talk about some practice ways with this next week, but that's the first kind of way. It's in this discomfort of not getting what we want. And so, you know, as part of the path, when the Buddha said practice with the three right intentions of kindness, goodwill, and doing no harm and renunciation, he's saying this practicing with renunciation is how you're going to begin to see this falling into clinging, falling into the absorption. It's amazing what we'll do to get desired objects, and what we'll say and how we'll act around people. So that's the first one. The second one is clinging to a kind of the views that we have. Our natural sense of opinions, beliefs, our thoughts about comparing mind, judging mind, fixing mind, this kind of connection into these views, this is a little bit different than the object. This is really more around our sense of ownership. There's a way that we think I've been trying to think all day, how do I help you see ownership when it comes to opinions and judgments? You can see ownership when it comes to your stuff, right? It's not just a car, it's my car. It's not just an apartment, it's my apartment, my stuff. We can see that ownership in it, and where that ownership is of my stuff, it always subjects us to suffering, because our stuff will not last. And this idea that this ownership of it, we expect it to stay the same way all the time. But it's like owning a house, owning an apartment. Yeah, it's a constant work in progress, trying to keep it all together. That part we could probably begin to see, I think. But where we trip up is in this sense of ownership of our opinions and ownership of our judgments and our comparing minds. The best kind of example I could think of, a way to explain this, is let's say I see someone walking down the street with some clothing or some outfit on that I don't think they should be wearing. You see a lot of that on Capitol Hill. So there's this automatic, I see something, I'm like, no, they didn't put that on walking out the house. Automatically, there is a sense that I know the appropriate way to dress. This ownership is connected to, I think that's what the sense is connected to. Yeah, the sense of I am, I have, I know. So when I see something that I don't like, I never think, oh, this is just my random opinion. I think that's not right. That's okay. That's not okay. This is the way we are with this sense of knowing, because we have a sense of knowing. And because we have in our minds a sense of knowing, we never question this idea that my knowing is just a subjective opinion. Instead, we think in terms of my knowing is a fact. My knowing is a truth. So as soon as I see something that I don't like, again, it's with the discomfort, I immediately think that is wrong. And I think everybody would assume that is wrong too. And there's just this expectation that this is the fact. So oftentimes, you may be like me, I have found that I will hear myself judging someone. And my immediate response is, stop that, Tori, stop that. Don't judge, right? Just let's move on to something else. I'll start thinking of metta, sending metta to the person, doing something to cut out that judging. What I don't do often, though I practice with this a lot, is turn and look at what am I thinking is wrong? Can I see that this thinking of the wrong thing is an opinion? It is a wanting something that's not available. Or as a Dana De Palma, one of the teachers that teaches nine bodies, she always says, I am wanting something from the universe that's not currently being offered. She's like, that is not what is offered to you to wear. What's offered to you is they are wearing what they want to wear. That is what's offered to you. And I don't want what's offered. But we don't see it like that. We don't see people in their clothes or people in their views or people doing what they do as an offering, their own offering into the world. We see it in terms of right and wrong. And always we come from the place that our thinking is right, and we know what's right and what's wrong. So this type of clinging, we are trying to see that the I have, I am, I know, that kind of understanding is really just a subjective, ordinary opinion. It's not truth in and of itself. It is an ordinary opinion. And that ordinary opinion is of no greater value than the person that wore something I didn't like. It has no greater value than that. It's why the Buddha questioned this comparing mind. Not just, do you think you're greater than someone, or do you think you're less than someone, but do you think you're the same? Just this kind of comparing mind, judging mind, all of this is part of this this way that we cling. So what we're trying to see is, can you see this getting so caught up in the sense of you and the rightness of you and what you know that you never bother to question what you're actually doing? It's not about just cutting off the judgment, cutting off the comparing mind. Okay, stop that. It's not even about, oh, that's their opinion and this is my opinion. It's whether or not you're actually willing to see the pain of someone having an opinion different than yours, when really we want everybody to agree with us. Agree with us, like us, we're right. It's hard. You know, I'm a Virgo, so it's hard. This is a hard one for me. But there is a way in which we could begin to see and question the ordinariness of all our opinions, all of our judgments, all our comparing, all our sense of what we think we know. I just want you to contemplate this over the next week before we start practicing with it. Just contemplate the idea that one area we get absorbed and we can't see is in seeking out what we like and what we want. The second area is in this sense of ownership and our giving greater value to our own opinions, our own judgments, our own beliefs, our own thinking. I read somewhere, this is called, that this is an inability to see bad systems of ethics and conduct. I think that is the weirdest way to say it. But basically what it's saying is we can't see when our system of what is appropriate and not appropriate is actually an opinion. We can't see that. We kind of assume and walk around with this assumption that there is somehow a right way to be in the world and a wrong way to be in the world. And we see that right way as the way I was raised, and the wrong way is is if you don't do it. You know, all that work I did in prison, this one and the next one, this is part of some of the hardest part about living in prison. And I always wondered how I would fare if I went to prison. And I mean, I'm assuming that I would eventually catch on. But what I didn't realize was how many prison norms there are that you have to abide by. And if you don't know, nobody tells you the norms. You got to kind of figure it out. But these norms are serious, and violating them is like disrespecting someone. So when you first come into prison, if you've never been in the system before, you're trying to figure out what's the appropriate way to be in the system without stepping on somebody's toes. Because some of the norms they have are pretty rigid, and you don't even, it's not necessarily the kinds of norms we have in our everyday life outside of prison, because they live in close quarters. So when you live in close quarters, you have these personal hygiene expectations that are very high, that you could step on somebody's toes in a minute. So the third one kind of goes into the same category. It's about being absorbed in what you could think of as morality or rites, rituals, rules, the way that we all are supposed to be. And we cling to, probably the easiest way to think about it is we cling to, let's say, the path rather than understanding what the path is trying to point to. So we cling to the rule or the ritual or the norm, like in prisons, and never question what exactly is this rule supposed to accomplish. So if the rule is supposed to accomplish general hygiene, then my hygienes are clean. But it doesn't work like that. It becomes the rule that you have to follow. And we have a lot of that. All you have to think about is, what if our weekly sit somehow changed and it wasn't the flow that we're used to? It would not take long before it would be like, oh, wait, something's wrong. We're not doing it right. This is the way, I mean, this is what Tim and I had to face when we started taking over for Rodney, because it was sort of like, there was this expectation of the way Rodney was, and neither Tim nor I could fill those shoes. So we're trying to be ourselves. And at the same time, it was rubbing against people. One example I'll give you, you know, when Rodney set up the room, when we were at Soto District, he set it up where everything faced forward. Not in a half circle, but in a box. And so he would sit in the middle, and if people were sitting on the ends, you would just be looking at a wall. So when it came time for me to teach, I don't like that. I wanted everything to be in a half circle. So I tried to make everything in that half circle. Oh my God. There was some difficulty about what was I doing? And I had to assure people I would put it back the way Rodney had it in order to just have a half circle for that month of December that I was going to teach. But it turned out okay, because at that point, people were like, oh, I kind of like this half circle. So we kind of kept it. But this is what this clinging is pointing to. As soon as something does not go the way you're used to, the tradition, the way we do it, there becomes this sense of it's wrong. We're doing it wrong. We got to fix it. We don't see that really that there is no doing it right or doing it wrong. There's just the doing of it. And we are trying to see into that doing of it. This is probably, I think the sense of rules and rituals is one of the first things that falls by the wayside when we actually step into this sense of stream entry. So there's a way in which letting go of having to have things go a certain way is probably, out of all of these absorptions, the easiest one to begin to sense into. But do not think it does not bring the same level of irritation. I'm going to give you another example. So when we were going to do the Sunday sit, and during the talk with the LDLs, we said, well, we want to have a Sunday sit, and we're going to have it with music. We're not going to have noble silence. We're going to do guided meditations. And Susan and I and Lindo had thought about this. You know, we talked about it, and this is what we were proposing, and we were telling the LDLs, and we were kind of encouraging the local Dharma leaders to come and participate in this thing. And I remember it was hilarious. People had this sense that it was just going to be wild, crazy chaos, that it was just going to be kids running everywhere, just like losing control. This is a Dhamma hall. This is a meditation place. This sense of reverence and sacredness was going to go out the window because I said music and not going to be held in noble silence. Because if you have kids, you can't really hold it in noble silence because they're not really going to abide by all that. But a parent needs to be able to tell their kids. And what I had to say was, wait, have you guys ever went to church? I mean, that's a sacred place. It has music. It's not held in noble silence. And sacredness is still there. But we're so used to silent meditations for 2 hours when we hear certain words. Our minds immediately go to the opposite. Like, this is just going to mess the whole thing up. This kind of practicing, you can only begin to see this. I'm hoping everyone can see this. You can see that you're stuck in a clinging when you feel the irritation, when you feel the, oh, that's not going to work. That right there says, okay, there's some clinging going on here, because you don't know if it's going to work. You're upset by the idea that we would change. And that right there is where clinging lies. So we want to try to look. We're going to talk about some ways to practice with this also. The last one has to do with this sense of there being a fixed self. And you know, this one is it's hard to see. To me, it's very hard to see because there is a self. There's something there. I know I'm sitting here and you're looking at me and there's a whole bunch of beings. We got 43. I can see the number there. So it's not like there's just blank little screens there. There's this being. And I don't think the Buddha, I don't think I've ever read anywhere where the Buddha said no self. What he said was there was this, it's non-self. It's not a fixed self. So here, this is probably more where you could maybe feel the comparing mind more so than in the one before. But this is that sense that I am a certain being. I grew up in a house that was extremely dysfunctional. And my role was the angry person. That's who I was. Many of you know this. I was the angry person. And I didn't have any choice in this matter. Somehow, I fell into that category, and it was expected that I would be angry. Everybody had their role to play in my family, and it was a big family. We all had our roles to play, and that was my role. And even after I left home, every time I would come home, I'd have to be angry about something. There'd be this poking and things would happen. And next thing you know, Tuareg's angry, always angry. This anger became this characterization of who I was. I always saw myself from the framework of anger, irritation, aversion. I don't like it. You know, I was so critical about everything. You know, I'm sure it helped me be a great lawyer because I could pick through anything and find a way to, you know, get you to say the wrong thing on the stand. I was known for that because I was so nice and cutthroat at the same time. And this is part of that energy around anger and passive aggression and you're poking, poking, poking. I grew up with this. So when I came into the Dhamma, I'm an angry person, right? So the Dhamma has to fix my angry person self. And that's pretty much what I tried, is how can I fix myself, fix myself, fix myself. I am angry, so how do I fix myself? We get so caught in seeing ourselves as particular fixed views that we don't see anything else. And so because I was an angry person, oftentimes I did not see my kindness. I did not see how funny I was. I couldn't see that I really was pretty easygoing. And that actually the anger, the more I practiced, the less it actually showed up in my life. It pretty much only showed up when I was at home. But when I was at home, I'd get so angry, I'd make up for the whole 2 months of not being angry. What I think the Buddha's pointing to is that when we hold this fixed view of who we think we are, who we think our partners are, who we think people should be, who we think other people are, is that we're clinging, absorbed into that view, and we never can come into the present moment with them. We don't come into the truth that people are changing all the time. We're rearranging all the time. And I would say, the hardest thing I've ever done with my family was when I realized I no longer wanted to live in the angry role and they still wanted me to. So, you know, when you grow up in a dysfunctional family, everybody's angry. I don't know why they gave it to just me, but, you know, I took it and that's my job, but everybody's angry. It's just more aggressive with me and passive with them. When I stopped expressing all this aggressive energy, they are left with their passive anger. And it would feel to me sometimes like they were begging me to please, you gotta be the angry one, Tuari, you gotta do it. Because if you don't do it, I gotta see myself as angry and I can't do that. So you gotta go back to being the angry one. And I could feel more pressure from their pleading for me to stay the same than I felt just from the poking and anger and acting out of the habit energy. If we're not willing to feel that discomfort, the discomfort that comes with the world wanting you to be the way you've always been, the discomfort of you can't get into this practice very long without coming up against some of this, I don't want to be that way anymore. I don't want to do that anymore. I don't want to be like that. I want to be like this. So there's a felt sense of discomfort in this tension between these fixed views of who we are and this Dhamma that we're practicing that opens up this possibility that I can be completely different. That tension, I think, is at craving. And clinging is when we just fall into these fixed views of ourselves. We don't like it, but I gotta be that. This is who I am. And this is how I am. And we just sort of, fall into the acceptance of that when we don't have to. And so we're gonna talk a little bit about how we can not just fall into these views of who we think we are, these fixed selves, and how can we leave open the possibility that I'm not like that anymore. So this clinging, this is the last of it I want to say, but this clinging is not, it's not, I think it's where the rubber meets the road. We can begin to see why the Buddha was so frantic about not wanting to teach us because of the obscurity of this. This is so obscure, and we have such a kind of wishing for the ease. We'll just put up with these four types of clinging and just live our lives out of it over and over and over and over and over. When in reality, the Dhamma is saying, you can rest here in this ouch, this wanting, and begin to see a way of liberation, a way to see outside of it. I think I wanted to close with this saying, but I don't think I have it. Yeah, I think I didn't. Wait, maybe this is it. Yeah, this is it. This is something Ajahn Chah said. An empty heart doesn't mean it's empty, as if there's nothing in it. An empty heart is empty of evil, but it's full of wisdom. So basically what I think practicing with clinging is about learning to see the wisdom of these four types of clinging, because mostly I think we can access them from the wisdom of knowing that they exist. And this wisdom to take a step back into the discomfort, that would be taking a step back into that felt sense of I don't like, so that we can begin to get more clarity around what these four types are, how they show up, what they show up, what they show up as. How do we liberate ourselves? So you're not trying to empty everything out. You're trying to cultivate wisdom that will help you and support you when we get stuck in these places of who we are. We get stuck in this clinging. Actually, a better way to say it is you're stuck in the dark and you can't see. The only light you're going to have is two things, wisdom and discomfort. Those two lights are going to help you see your way through the dark. So let's take a moment and just sit quietly for a second, and then we'll see if there's any questions. Thank you so much for your kind attention. I appreciate it. Let's see if there's any questions. There's a couple of pages here. So if you would like to have a question, it would be easier for me to know if you open up your participants little tab at the bottom and go down to the bottom of that list and click on raise hand. That would help me know who. Good, Susan. Jackie, have we turned off everybody's allow people to unmute themselves? Yeah. Oh no, I'll do it. Hold on. Okay, Susan, you should be able to.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
I thought I knew which type of clinging I was looking at, but now I'm wondering if I went to the easy one. But so here's what I'm sensing that's happening. It's happening even at the edges of waking up. So I'm sleeping and I'm waking up in the morning, and I'm noticing just the edge of cognition, really, that I'm desiring that coffee. And it's almost, the image is like a baby with a binky. Mm-hmm. And I feel like it's, I think it's going to give me some sense of security, and like I can't live without it. My body's kind of rushing right now, and it feels really tender, like it's so tied to my fabric of, you know, like I can't live without it. It's so tied to my fabric of being okay in the world. I mean, it seems so huge.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking that that might be a view and not a sense pleasure. You know, that sense of, well, actually, I don't know. I think I just want to frankly ask.
I don't know either. I mean, it sounds like a sense. I think there's a view there, which is true. And I'm sure that you could have more than one of these types intersected together, because getting the coffee is going to stabilize things. But it seems like there's a lot of putting inappropriate level of requirement or satisfaction in the coffee.
Right.
I tell you this, though. We are lay people. So we are going to practice with coffee. We are not trying to not have coffee. What we are trying to do is notice what you're noticing about this falling into having to have it a certain way. And the way to get out of that stuck place is instead of making the coffee and then shower and then make the coffee, do something else in between. You don't have to give up the coffee.
Mm-hmm.
You just begin to put other things in front of it.
Yes.
So that you can begin to see that you don't die. And that's then you right. can disrupt that thinking that I have to do this right away.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. I am practicing with a lot of things like that.
That's
so,
right.
Good. And not having to have the answer, just to see the discomfort and to feel it.
That's right. The
Let
discomfort
it
is good enough. That's right.
Okay. Thank you.
Welcome. Jean?
Thank you for that talk. So interesting. So I recognize myself as being a very opinionated person. I own that.
You know. Me too.
And sometimes I'm aware of it. You know, Bernie Glassman used to say, just my opinion, man.
That's right.
It's a way of kind of lightening it up.
Yeah.
But, you know, I'm thinking like where opinion slides into conviction or appears to be. I mean, I have very strong opinions. Let's just take the political situation. You know, and I feel like certain practices, certain views, and certain ways of being in the world are harmful.
Yeah.
And it could be my opinion, but fine. You know, I mean, I don't. So, I mean, I try to work with remembering that people on the other end of the spectrum are in some cases, many cases, speaking from their heart, and they just want to be happy too, blah, blah, blah. But, you know.
I think I think we always come into this difficulty here. I have these huge arguments with my son about this, you know, because I think part of the problem isn't, do I disagree with some views on the political scale that I think are harmful? It's the judgment that all of these people believe that. The Republicans believe this. The Democrats believe this. And that is when we start getting into problems, because we're pigeonholing people into understandings without knowing that particular person and how that particular person is. So we get caught in the aversion and the hatred, and that hatred is what precedes it.
Mm-hmm.
The reality of it is we are going to always live in a world with a whole bunch of different views. For instance, if I'm not mistaken, the term limits of a presidency came under Roosevelt, right? Because he was just going to stay and become a dictator forever. And there were so many people that hated what Roosevelt was doing. But Roosevelt had a lot of power. He wielded that power. He had a lot of control over a lot of things, and he did not care whether you liked what he was doing or not. So the people that liked what Roosevelt was doing, they're all like, we love Roosevelt. And I was telling my son this because he loves Roosevelt. And I'm like, you should hold it a minute. Because to the other side, Roosevelt was way off the charts, way too far. This is unacceptable. And for many years, there's been this push to try to fix what Roosevelt did. And yet for many people, they worship the ground that Roosevelt walked on because of all the support and all the help he did for so many people. So it really depends on who you ask as to whether or not Roosevelt was a great president or, you know, way outside the bounds of the Constitution that we had. This understanding, I'm not trying to compare Roosevelt with our current president. What I'm trying to get us to see is that just because we think this is absolutely the way it should be and this is absolutely the way it shouldn't be, that's where the difficulty comes in. It's more around making sure that you do your contribution that you feel is appropriate for you as a citizen and that you do that contribution to the best that you're able to do. You support who you can support. You give when you can give. You're there. You're part and parcel connected to what's going on. And you don't just allow, just ignore your civic duties. I think if everybody got involved in their civic duties, we would just see things quite differently right now. But this is about people actually just standing up for their convictions without having to force the rest of the world to live in them. And so it's hard in this political system. There's no right, wrong answer. I can't give that. But I do know that your suffering that comes from being stuck in a view is far worse than this ability to let go of the view and rest in the present moment with all its difficulties and all its challenges. The being stuck in a view is just forcing us to say, these people got to be like this. We got to do this. And we can't make anybody do anything. That's why my son and I had the argument, because when RBG died, notorious RBG, when she died, it threw him back into my sister dying. And so he's like overwhelmed in despair, and trying to get him out of that despair is difficult because he thinks the world is coming to an end. But I don't know how to say it. I don't know if people think like me. Maybe it's because I'm a history fanatic. We have lived through difficulty as human beings many, 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 many times. And this is not the end of our difficulties, because even if we change the president, we have a huge climate change matter that we have to take up, and that is going to be equally as difficult. So it's not like there's some way we can fix things and make it not difficult. It's going to be difficult for a long time. And so it's more about not getting so caught up in the fight of it and just doing what we can within our own practice to support as many as we can. You see what I'm saying? It's difficult. I know.
Yeah.
We're going to talk about some ways to practice a little bit with it next week.
Yeah. It's a lot to think about.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Steve? You're muted, Steve. So if you're talking to us, we don't know.
Oh, I pressed unmute, but it didn't work.
Okay, we'll forgive you.
I think I'd like to get to know your son.
He's having some difficulties, man. I feel for him, man. I was walking down the street and we were screaming at each other. So I know a lot of people heard me talking to him.
Okay, so I think this is why I at one point thought I want to become a grumpy old man. because you said in the moment of irritation, one has access to the processes of mind that create the suffering, the falling yeah. into the absorption of clinging.
Yeah, that's grumpy old man.
Yeah. Okay, so I guess I'm asking you about the tendency to just want a change of mind. You know, the not drink coffee for the buzz or I mean, you know, not for the ritual or whatever, but just, okay, I'm in this irritated frame of mind for a long time. I just need to change it.
How come?
Yeah, well, that's a good question.
I mean, that's what you have to ask. How come you have to change it? What, do you think if you change it to a better state of mind, that somehow or another, that better state of mind is going to make things better? Because it's only going to be temporary and it'll shift.
Well,
what I think the Buddha was pointing to is that real liberation comes from allowing the irritable state of mind to exist, because it is present. It is there. And it's the wanting something other than this to be present that's the difficulty. That's where we start getting into problems. You can investigate around the edges of it to see, where is this difficult mind? What are the conditions and causes that are pushing this up here? But the trying to get rid of something that the universe has currently offered you is part of the problem. That's probably the main problem, is the trying to get rid of something that's present. You see what I'm saying?
Yes, that's just what we do.
But see, the difficulty with difficult states of mind is that we have a story around that difficult state of mind, and what we're stuck in is the story. We just don't see that story because it's so part of the clinging nature of it. So difficult states of mind are as temporary as sensation. But if you're stuck in the story, it's not going to go away. Because in the background, it's like at a computer. You don't know why all your energy is being used up, but it's got all them programs running in the back. You eating up all your stuff. And so that energy is run. That story is playing out in the back of your mind over and 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 over. You don't look at it. You don't see it. But it doesn't mean it's not playing in the background. And the only way you're going to begin to see that there's a story playing in the background is you have to be willing to be with this difficult state of mind and allow it to be there in such a way that you can feel into it. This is what it feels like. It feels like to have an irritable mind. And you can begin to see what's playing in the background. But mostly we can't see that because we just want to get rid of the irritable mind. But it's so temporary. You can get rid of it, it'll come right back. Get rid of it, come right back. Get rid of it, come right back. Okay? We'll talk about practicing with it next week. I know we want to practice with it, but I just want you to begin to think about the four and see how much a part of who you are it is. Yeah, Ron.
It was interesting. You were talking about family because we had pretty much the same type of family. You know, I was the oldest and I had a certain role, and I had that all through my life. Even after my parents had died, I was the oldest, so I had responsibilities. But anyway, yep. Not that I wanted them, but they were there.
I know.
Nobody would step up to the plate. But anyway, in dealing with this, you know, I think sometimes dealing with an irritable mind, sometimes I can turn that to just be a little more inquisitive along with that irritation.
It is, but.
But so here's an example. I used to travel quite a bit. So I was in upstate New York, pretty conservative part of the country. And I started talking to this guy. He was retired military. And once we kind of got close to politics, he was just talk radio. You know, there was no real thoughts in his head. It was just talk radio. So I listened, and, you know, he went, I mean, it was one of these short interactions. I didn't have to endure it. But I thought about that. What I do is I try to, if I'm gone for very long, I try to challenge myself into something that's going to make me irritated already. I'm already a little irritated. But I always try to seek out this other person's opinion. And because it's so easy, you know, they're here, you get an opinion, you're gone. And then you can mull it over later. It's pretty straightforward. And I found that has really helped me to understand that, one, my opinions are just, you know, like everybody's got a belly button, everybody's got an opinion, you know. So, but also it surprises me how many ways people are the same, even though we believe completely differently.
Yeah, we
basically
are.
We're the same. And it's what I don't understand is, and I work through the Dharma, but this is, how do I as a person understand the core of this person? You know, like, how could we find common ground? And sometimes that works and sometimes it doesn't, but each time it gets a little easier.
Ron, I want to point a little bit here to us, because this isn't about the people we have difficulty with. So granted, it's kind of an easy place to see I'm struggling when I have difficulty with someone. That's not what this is pointing to automatically. When you get up in the morning, you have opinions about life, everything. We believe things exist as they exist in this absoluteness all day long. The question is, are we ever going to begin to challenge our assumptions, our expectations, our basic beliefs, as not our spiritual beliefs, but our basic beliefs that the world should be this way? This is more about, not about trying to get along with people. This is more about beginning, because, you know, we are householders. So there's going to be some degree of, you know, clinging that's going to happen all the time. So it's not about whether or not we have the capacity to get along with someone. Because I, like you, did the same thing. I mean, I just started talking to people I didn't necessarily agree with. It was easy for me. I worked in a police station. There's a lot of Republicans in there. But that's not what the Dhamma is pointing to. We suffer because we want something other than what is offered to us. We want something else. It's so easy. It's so flippant. It's so constant. Mostly, we just get what we want, and we don't have any difficulty, and we go along with life, and then we just keep getting what we want all the time. If it's not offered, we rearrange the conditions a bit and get what we want. We just do it all the time, all the time, all the time, all the time. So what this Dhamma is pointing to is to begin to see that, not to make your life miserable, not to get stuck in only trying to like all the people you don't like. I argue with my son. I walking up and down Capitol Hill arguing with him just 2 days ago. It's not about trying to make your life beautiful, better. Okay, I'm going to get along with everybody. It's about beginning to be willing to consider where you are asleep, where you just roll through life without any question. And if we can begin to be willing to challenge the places we're asleep, then we're going to see the difficulty. It's not about trying to fix the times when the difficulty is already present. That's like low-hanging fruit. We already know we don't like something. What we're trying to look at are the times when everything is rolling smooth, going the way I want it. Can you see that there's still a wanting in there and a getting what you want, a wanting, getting what I want, a wanting, getting what I want? And because we just roll along and get what we want, get what we want, get what we want, when we come up against something when we don't want it and we can't make it work, we're caught in that anger. And we think it's because of this situation, but it's not. It's the continuation of a clinging, cyclical kind of thing where we've just been rolling along getting what we want all the time. This is what I think this is pointing to, is the beginning to see, you know, just challenge it a little bit. Not make your life miserable, but challenge a little bit. Kind of feeling around the edges a little bit. Sort of what you're saying with people you're talking about, with people you disagree with, but you could do the same thing with just, oh, I'm going to go watch TV. And then don't. And then see what happens. It can get a little disruptive when we don't follow through on what the mind wants. And this is what I think this part is pointing to. Just the beginning to see how closed in our world is and how little access we have to information outside of that.
I agree with all of that, and I have some real, it's really been helpful. But I still like to hear what other people think, and then it challenges my opinions and my thinking for change. And yes. Some people are that way, but what I usually get challenged is like what you said, when I'm cruising through and somebody comes up and puts a stop sign in front of me and I can't get past to go do what I want to. And I have to either move the stop sign or I have to stop and talk to the person moving that stop sign, or I have to change my ways of doing things.
Yeah.
Take a right or a left.
Well, I'm poking a little bit at our easy life. I'm not poking at the places where, we're willing to challenge. I'm poking at the places where we're not willing to challenge. And I'm poking a little bit at, you know, maybe we should give it a look-see over the week and see where am I pretty much riding the good way. I got to go, though, because I have to do some announcements, and Deb is probably going to be like, Tuareg, time is ticking away. I don't want to try to get them all in 2 minutes. She said 4 minutes. I'm already messed up.